with respect to sentient beings, if you fall with respect to sentient beings, you've gotten angry, you've been neglectful, you're jealous or proud or, you know, ungenerous, miserly or whatever. In order to purify that, you rely on sentient beings by developing bodhicitta, that is, the aspiration to achieve enlightenment for their sake, out of compassion, out of friendliness and kindness. So that power of reliance sometimes can come first. At the beginning of some purification practices, the first thing we do is take refuge and generate bodhicitta. So that constitutes the power of reliance. And then we think about the negative actions we've created in order to recognize them. Geshe Darge, one of my teachers in India, used to say that we might take our rosary and count the negative actions that we've created today. Or if you're like most of us and the number of negativities are perhaps even greater, you might use your computer. Your word processor, or I don't know, whatever. You know. So think of the negative actions. Over time, you start to recognize, as your mind gets more and more inclined to the Dharma and familiar with the Dharma, you start to recognize more of your actions have not been skillful. They've been motivated out of self-interest. So to feel some regret for those negative actions, unskillful actions, those that you recognize, we said some harsh words, we reacted, we got angry, we were cranky, people were late for a meeting with us and we got angry and we stalked out, to recognize that this was the result of our negative mind, and to regret that as though we've ingested poison. Remember, did I give this example? If we're eating pizza together, one of my favorite foods. Do you like pizza? You're generally, most people like pizza. So we're eating pizza, and you're talking. You're asking Dharma questions, and I'm sloppily eating, and you've had a few bites of the pizza, and you notice that I start foaming at the mouth and choking, and I'm falling over, and you recognize the pizza has got some poison or something in it, right? Bad food. At that point, how would you feel about having eaten a few bites of the pizza? Would you feel guilty? That doesn't make sense, right? To feel guilty. What would you feel? Regret. And you would try to seek the antidote of that, right? Some remedy. You'd feel, I shouldn't be eating, that regret is a thought that I shouldn't be doing this, that stops you from doing it, and I shouldn't, gives you the energy not to do it in the future. I shouldn't have eaten this. So in the same way, when we've done negative actions, the power of regret means to recognize the results of that negative action, like having ingested poison. I'm going to experience suffering in the future. I should not have done this. That action itself of regret, or another way we can say remorse, even though it may not purify an action completely, it can start to erode the effects of that negative karma so that it becomes much less powerful. The opposite of remorse is to feel good about what we did. We insult someone in public place, and afterwards we come home and we gloat. Oh God, I really got them. Oh boy, did they suffer. They felt so humiliated. That's the opposite of remorse. That makes the negative karma that we've created even more powerful. Can you see that? But feeling some hesitancy, even hesitancy, when you're about to do something that's negative, even if you can't stop yourself, to feel some hesitancy, I shouldn't be doing this, but still might come out, whether verbal or physical or whatever, still even feeling hesitancy makes a very big difference. Even though you can't control your mind and you might feel later completely miserable, terrible Dharma practitioner, I got angry, I said bad words, or I lied, or I stole, or whatever. Even to recognize that as negative and to feel it wasn't right is very close to regret. To actually regret starts with that hesitancy, right? And will prevent you, in a sense. It helps to prevent you from doing that in the future. It helps to kind of break the powerful nature of that karma. It's the opposite of rejoicing in the negative action. In the same way, when we do something virtuous, we can either rejoice or regret the virtuous action. Can you imagine regretting a virtuous action? Have you ever done that? I bet you have. I was like, say, for instance, you're going down the street and you think, oh, I must practice Dharma. You give some change to the beggar. Then you go into the coffee shop and they say it's $1.17. And you don't have the 17 cents. Oh, I shouldn't have given to that beggar. Yeah. Some example, yeah. If you regret the virtue that you've created, also you diminish its efficacy in the same way that when you regret negative karma, you diminish its efficacy. If you rejoice in the virtue, you increase the power of that. So when we do negative actions, rather than feeling some complacency about it, or even forgetting it, trying to forget it, okay, forget it. To feel some regret about it, that's a very powerful antidote. In addition, third power, we say the first power is the power of reliance, refuge in bodhicitta, feeling regret, the second one. Third one, making a resolution or promise not to do it again. Some kind of inner decision. I shouldn't do this in the future. If you can, once your mind becomes powerful, you can make a resolution not to do that for a longer and longer period of time. Resolving not to do an action, again, is very, very important because it is a way to cut the continuity of doing those actions. You know, when we talk about karma, there are said to be four results of any negative action that we do, four possible results, depending on how heavy the action is. Do you know what those are? The four ripening, the four ways that a karmic deed can ripen?
No.
Okay. So the one way is the throwing karma, and we'll say what that means, the environmental result. So the throwing result, the environmental result.
The result similar to the cause, the result similar to the action.
So sometimes in the scriptures, that's right, sometimes in the scriptures they say three. They say the ripening effect or maturation effect, the environmental effect, and the result similar to the cause. So it's three. The result similar to the cause. You see my fingers here? That has two. Result similar to the cause as an action. That means to do the thing again and again. Habitual result. And the result similar to the cause as a experience. That means if you've killed, to be killed. Yeah. So of those four results, we might think, maybe the result similar to the cause as an experience is the worst. If you say harsh words, to hear harsh words, or if you've killed, to be killed. If you've refrained from being generous, not to find resources in the future, you might think that's the worst result. Or you might think the maturation result is the worst. The maturation result means the result of being born a whole lifetime in some realm. The result of negative karma is always the maturation result is always to be born in the lower realms. You can't be born in the upper realms by creating virtuous karma, by some like sometimes if you in the hierarchy of bureaucracy of the United States, you might actually get checked back from the government even though you owe it money, right, by some fluke. But the karma doesn't work that way. You're not going to be born in the upper realms from having killed someone. right? But you might think those are the worst results, but actually the worst of these results is the result similar to the cause as an action. What did I call it? The habitual result. Like lying, getting in the habit of lying, stealing, killing, so forth, having the karmic seed on your mind then to easily get into that action again. Do you follow what I'm saying? How can you break that? What is the particular of these four opponent forces? What is the particular force that acts as an explicit antidote to that? Resolving not to do the action again. Promising not to do again. In particular, this is the reason that some people take ordination. The Buddha gave the vows of monks and nuns and of lay people particularly to break the continuity of our negative actions. Like, if you vow not to kill, and you're conscious of that throughout your life, you remember that I've got vows, even though, you know, someone says, oh, come on, help me put this poison out. And you think, oh, I've got the vow of not killing. That helps to stop that habitual action of killing in the future. If you made a vow not to steal, and your mind might be tempted at various times and say, oh, I could take that. And you remember that you have this vow, that helps to stop that continuity. Because how do you stop the continuity? You need to break it at some point. You need to have some kind of dam that stops that. So that particular opponent force is very, very powerful. It can be manifested in a lifetime of practice of taking vows. So that's in a sense, the taking of vows is that opponent force, the resolving not to do the action. Remember when we talked about ethics before? Taking a vow for a whole lifetime is much different. It's much more powerful than simply refraining from some negative action on one occasion. So you didn't take the vow not to steal. And on one occasion you were tempted and you said, no, I'm not going to steal because that creates negative karma. Oh, you created virtue in that way, but that's an isolated act. If you had made a vow, however, in the presence of the Buddha with ritual that the Buddha created, not to steal for your entire life, even when you don't have the opportunity to steal, you're creating virtuous karma. So it's said that those of you who have lay vows, even when you're asleep, when your mind is distracted, you're creating virtuous karma if you still have the resolution in your mind to keep those vows. Okay? And then the fourth, so we say that the power of reliance, which is bodhicitta and refuge, the power of regret, the power of resolving not to do the action, and the power of antidote. This is in a sense, say for instance, if you've stolen and you've applied these other three opponent forces, still there might be some residue that you didn't completely purify. So in the future you might be deprived of resources. So one way to counteract is to create virtue and dedicate it as an antidote to that negative action, so that in the future, even though you might not have resources because this negative karma is ripening, someone else will give you what you needed because you created this virtue, you created some virtuous karma as an antidote. I don't know if I've explained that clearly. Do you understand what I mean? Sort of like mixing, even though there might be some residue of black karma left, like a string of black that's still left, you've entwined it with something white, you know, some virtuous karma. It's said that if you apply these four opponent forces, there is no negative karma that cannot be purified. There's nothing that you've done that cannot be purified if you apply these four opponent forces again and again. It doesn't mean that you just think, oh, I shouldn't have done that. It's purified now. It's not, you know, you have to have, again, you have to apply again and again and to feel very strongly these practices. So these are two of the preparations to create virtue whenever whatever negative situations are arising, or even favorable ones, to give it, to use it as an instigator of you creating virtuous karma. And when negative things happen, to help you to instigate the purification of negative karma. Third one is offering tormas. You know what tormas are? It's a Tibetan word. It means that which is to be tossed away. Tormas are ritual cakes that are offered, or something. In India, the offerings that were done, tormas, were sometimes just a plate of food that you offer to the Buddhas and the protectors of the Dharma, let's say. And you make, in order to make a request, when you request something of, say, if you're going to an official, you always bring some present, right? First of all, or if you're going to ask Uncle Charlie for something, you always bring something. You bring a box of candy or something like that, or Grandma, and then you make your request, right? You give them something first. So in a similar way, you try to create some virtue, offering to the Buddhas and the protectors of the Dharma. And you request, generally what people think when they make torma offerings to the protectors of the Dharma, they think, oh, please protect me from all adverse conditions, may I have wealth. In fact, even the prayers say that, may the harvests be good, may I have long life, and all these psychic powers, and may goodness flourish, and so forth. This is generally what we pray for. But the practitioner of the mind training practices in a different way. They say, whatever would be good, if it would be better that I have suffering, may I suffer. If it be better that I have favorable conditions, may I have favorable conditions. If it is better for me to have long life, may I live long. If it be better that I die, may I die now. When one first encounters this, usually this is the way the real practitioners, at the beginning we practice, may I have long life, all the good things, when you make offerings to the Buddhas. Or if you go to the gurus, you go to your guru and you say, please pray that I not be born in the lower realms, may I have long life. You might ask your gurus for this kind of help or something. But a real practitioner actually prays for the opportunity to continue to practice in the most authentic way. If suffering were to be beneficial for my practice, may I have suffering. So in that way, if you pray in that way, you can recognize then when adverse conditions come, this is the blessing of the gurus. Let's take a little break. I think people are getting a little achy, huh? Let's take a 15-minute break.
Wow, that was only two gongs. I think that it was good that you had a big break.
Because when you had a shorter break, it took you longer to get back. You were braked out, I think. That's good. Okay. Now I know. I learned. You need a good break. How are you feeling? Okay?
Yeah. Huh?
So we're talking about these four. So in this context, we're talking about transforming adverse conditions into the path. And we talked about these various ways to do it, to recognize our suffering as an opportunity for growth, to see that this is the result of my past negative karma, and to feel some joy in that. One of our esteemed guests, Doctor, was mentioning that although he grew up in India and his mom used to tell him about karma and so forth, when we just see as so-called scientific people of this lifetime, we just see this life, we might have a lot of doubt about karma because we don't see the results of karma ripening this lifetime. We see bad things happening to good people and good things happening to bad people, right? The mafia guy or the what do they call it, the Colombian drug cartel having big estate or something like this and having all sorts of pleasures and yachts and stuff like that. And we think, wow, why should this karma doesn't work. But karma is something more subtle. Karma is something that is a deeply hidden phenomena. Remember when we talked about three kinds of phenomena, manifest, hidden, and deeply hidden. The connection between a particular action and the actual final result is something that you can't even infer. Not only can't you see with your senses, the Buddha can perceive this with his mind, we can't even infer that by giving a particular, you know, some money to a beggar now or a loaf of bread to someone, we can't infer in what life, at what time, in what way that will ripen. We just have confidence from the Buddha's teachings that it will ripen in something which is pleasant in the future. We will have resources as a result of that. That you can infer, but you can't infer or know directly in what way it will ripen. That's something that's called deeply hidden, that we have to rely on the prophecy of the Buddha, someone with omniscient mind, to say in what way that will ripen. And the confidence in karma increases over time. Dharmakirti and Dignaga, these great logicians of Buddhism, Indian logicians, they said that by understanding the Buddhist teachings on emptiness and selflessness, something which at first is not easily explainable. You know, you kind of think, oh, bodhicitta, renunciation, these are things, the words I can understand, concepts I can understand, but emptiness, boy, oh boy, you know, this is really hard. But by making an insight into that, recognizing how liberating it is, this hidden phenomena that Buddha revealed, emptiness, incredible faith arises in the Buddha as a perfect teacher, as a valid being. In Indian language, we say pramana, valid. Then one goes back and reevaluates that which you have superficially accepted on faith, perhaps, certain confidence in the existence of past and future lives and karma. And you have incredible faith and confidence that the Buddha would not have deceived us about these things which are, you know, manifest phenomena or, let's say, deeply hidden phenomena. He would not have deceived us about these because he's been so kind in illuminating something that has been so liberating, you know, the understanding of emptiness. So that might be one way to help in that regard. So when we talk about these four applications, ways now to utilize the adverse conditions, when adverse conditions happen, use it as an opportunity to generate virtuous karma, to instigate your creation of virtue. Use it to instigate your purification. If when adverse conditions arise, you need to purify. So use that to apply the four opponent forces. If you want to offer to the protectors, the worldly way of doing it is to offer to the protectors of the Dharma. Have you heard that expression before? Maybe you don't hear. Dharmapalas, we call the protectors of the Dharma. There are various emanations of Buddha. We call them supramundane protectors. Actually, emanations of Buddha that are more accessible to us because they have a grosser form. Sometimes wrathful. Oftentimes wrathful forms. And they may have amongst their entourage or retinue worldly spirits. They're like the big black sort of heavyweight, you know, scary kind of spirit, and the other spirits in their entourage follow their lead, so they can help to bring about worldly activities. They're more accessible to us, these aspects of the Buddha's mind, than the more pristine aspects. On the field of merit, like in the Guru in Lama Chopa, this, I don't know if we have another version here, but it's, some of you can't see right here. At the very top, we have the gurus. Below that, we have the meditational deities, then the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, the Pratika Buddhas, the hearers. Then what comes below that? The Dakas and Dakinis, and finally the protectors of the Dharma. They're the most accessible to us, in a sense, the lowest rung. Although they may be supramundane protectors, may be emanations of the Buddha's minds, they're of a form that's more accessible to us. Like if we wanted to go see the governor of the state, and we would just go to the mansion and say, I want to see the governor, we might not be able to go in to see. But if we were to go to see one of the local representatives of that could talk to the governor and intercede on our behalf, we might have better luck, right? It's like in Chicago, if you want to see the mayor, difficult. But if you want to see the local, you know, to get your road fixed in front of the house that's been broken up for months, you go to you can't see the mayor, but you can see the local, what do they call it, alderman or something like that, more easy. So we make offerings to the protectors generally in the various kinds of rituals that are done. We ask them for all of these good things, but a real practitioner of mind training actually asks kind of like, bring it on. you know, if it's better for me to suffer, may I suffer. If it's better that I have, no hindrances right now, please bring about that. So praying and always having that feeling that one is, whatever happens to one is for the best. Also, one offers the fourth application or fourth preparation is offering even to spirits. Now, we don't, in our culture, we don't have so much belief in spirits, do we? Maybe the Asian culture, do you folks believe in spirits? How about Americans? You guys, do you believe in spirits, Patrick?
No.
Yeah. When there's something happens, you know. In Asia, I gave a talk in Singapore once about, not explicitly about spirits, but on death, the bardo, the intermediate state and rebirth, you know, ghosts, kind of ghosts. And it was the biggest number of people that had ever come to this auditorium for a talk that was presented by the Dharma Center there. I think there were 950 people that came. They had to turn people away because Asian people are very interested in, not so much India, I think. We don't talk so much in India about it. More China, Singapore and Hong Kong and Taiwan, things like that. So, also in Tibet, there was a practice of offering, when you have interferences, offering a torma, cake, to the spirits. In fact, when you do retreat, at the beginning of the retreat, you offer a torma, some kind of cake, to the spirits that are there and say, you might do some ritual, but the essence of it is this. You try to meditate and invite them and say, look it, I'm going to try to do something virtuous, which will benefit you in the end. Please take this offering. It's not just a physical cake. You try to meditate on its nature as being very blissful. Please take this and as an offering and don't cause any harm. The practitioner of the mind training might do that in some circumstances, but they might actually say, you've done a good job bringing me a lot of harm up till now. And it's been of great benefit for my practice. Bring it on. You know. So this is something that our minds would find, at first, might find very difficult, even asking elemental spirits to provide more grist for our practice. But maybe you could imagine a time in the future when we would be in such a position, when our mind would be just not so concerned about the outer circumstances, our outer success or our physical comfort and so forth, but our actual spiritual progress. So there, when we talk about these four applications, they can be the last two can be practiced in these two ways. Right now at our level, asking that outer hindrances be eliminated and so forth, both to the Dharma protectors and the elemental spirits. Later, maybe when we're inspired to actually have that sense of requesting whatever is good, if I ask the Dharma protectors, the super mundane Dharma protectors, if it's better that I die, may I die. If it's better that I have long life, may I live long. If it's better that I be sick to purify negative karma, may I be sick. Not just to purify negative karma, it may give me the opportunity of meditating on compassion. Many different things. Okay. So this is the section, the third point of transforming adverse conditions into the path. I think it's a very, very powerful way of practicing in everyday life. Whatever is happening, here is giving you ways of whatever happens to try to utilize that as material for your meditation. When we do the Lama Chopa Puja tomorrow, the Guru Puja in the evening, there is a verse on this, and you'll recognize it when we do the glance meditation on the stages of the path. Okay. So now the next point here in this text is called elucidating a lifetime's practice. So this is very, very good. This has a couple of parts to it. Here it says, gather together the abridged quintessence of this advice. Blend the practice of one life with the five forces. So you might think, oh gosh, another list. 7 points, 4 applications, 5 opponent, 4 opponent forces. Now he's talking about 5 forces. This guy is never-ending numerologist. Okay, but this is very useful. The 5 forces. This is a way, in a sense, this is, if you try to think of how, in the long term, how you can understand the practice of our lifetime, what are we going to try to do? Basically, you could say in a very brief way, not talking about 5 forces, what I want to try to do in everyday life all the time is to try to generate these 2 minds of bodhicitta, altruistic mind of bodhicitta, working for the welfare of others out of compassion and love. And on the other hand, having this deep wisdom that we try to cultivate over time, ultimate bodhicitta, that sees the essencelessness of things, how phenomena, how our own self and other phenomena lack a certain kind of reality that our mind attributes to them that causes all our problem, that causes that kind of like iridescent attraction of things that we really think there's really something there to get. So we try to alternate in our practice in a lifetime, all of our practices meditating on trying to develop those 2 states of mind. But here when we talk about the 5 forces, the first force is the force of resolution. In Tibetan we say pempe to. Pempa means to project. So it's projection in this sense. When you make a strong resolution to do something, you can kind of create the inertia for that to come about. It's kind of like motivation. I don't know if I mentioned, I don't think I mentioned to you, when my dad was a young man, when he was 13, his dad died. And this was in 1929. And my father had to go out and get a job to support his siblings and his mom. And he got a job as a truck driver, I think. I don't know how he got a job as a truck driver at 13, but that was 1929. So he had to get up sometime very early in the morning, 4 o'clock, something like that. And he found that if he made a very strong determination before he went to bed, I'm going to wake up at 4. I've got to get up at 4. Even if he set the alarm at 4, he would wake at 3:59. Have you ever noticed that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, isn't it? So this is a little bit like that. Here, what we're talking about, the force of projection or determination, is that we make a determination to practice the spiritual path, especially these minds. When you wake up in the morning, first thing in the morning, think, today, I'm going to practice for the benefit of others. I'm going to try to overcome my self-cherishing thought, remember the kindness of others. remember the path and so forth, try to be introspective. That kind of determination in the morning it acts like inertia, that it will carry us through the day. Just as in the same way that if you make a very strong determination to wake up at a certain hour, that determination can actually bring about that in the future, some future event. Also, if you make a strong determination to remember your dreams, to remember that you're dreaming in a dream. It's said that this is one of the methods that's taught in when we talk about dream yoga, a way to utilize sleep in the path. One of the first things is just making a very strong determination, just as you're lying on your pillow going to sleep, I'm going to remember my dreams and recognize them as dreams. I'm going to be conscious in the dream and recognizing, I'm dreaming. Mm-hmm. So let me read you a little bit what Geshe Repton said in this context. There are five forces we should practice throughout the rest of our life, as well as through all future existences. The first is the force of motivation. This is what I'm calling determination. This means that we should be vigilant in every moment so that when emotional afflictions arise, we can stop them immediately. So make a very strong motivation in general for your whole lifetime. In the morning, that I'm going to watch my mind and be vigilant whenever disturbing states of mind arise. I'm going to confront and avert them without any delay. I think, the lamas that have very high realization, great gurus, yogis and yoginis, when they take rebirth, they take rebirth with a certain motivation. I'm going to take rebirth in this fertilized egg. Those of you who are familiar with the tantric sadhanas, maybe you know, we even talk about this, motivated to take rebirth in order to benefit sentient beings. By that motivation, their whole life takes on a certain texture because of that motivation, a certain inertia. In general, when we talk about karma, there are two kinds of motivation. I mentioned to you when we do our motivation at the beginning of the class, motivation is the most important thing that determines the quality of the karma that we create. It's not so much the action as the motivation. Even if you're washing dishes, if you're thinking, if you're motivating in this way and you're thinking, by my, in this way may I clean off all of the delusion from the minds of sentient beings. It may look to you, to someone else, that person is doing some minor, trivial task, whereas the people in the Gompa who are making prostrations are doing real Dharma practice. Maybe the people in the Gompa who are making prostrations are thinking, oh, I've done more than them. I've done them better. Now, I've become the Kadampa champion of prostration, something like that. The motivation may not be pure. So the person who's washing the dishes or mopping the floor with a motivation, thinking, like this, may I eliminate the delusions from the minds of all sentient beings. And as you're washing, you actually see the dirt going away, and it leaves an imprint of the possibility of that, what actually is creating virtuous karma. So there are two kinds of motivation. There's a causal motivation that comes at the beginning of an action that determines the general quality of the whole action. And then there's the temporal motivation during the action. Of the two, the causal motivation is more important. For instance, if you're doing some action at the beginning, you motivate very strongly with the highest of motivations, like to benefit sentient beings, to achieve enlightenment for their welfare. Even if during the action your mind becomes distracted and your temporal motivation diminishes, by the force of your causal motivation at the beginning, kind of like the initial inertia that set things into effect, the whole action becomes virtuous. temporal motivation is also important. Even if you enter into something and you didn't enter into it with a special motivation, if during that action you recall motivation, a special motivation, and see that you should have it, that can cause those moments to be special, to be especially virtuous. But the causal motivation is most important. So the lamas who take rebirth, almost as though the whole lifetime on the basis of that causal motivation becomes virtuous. Also at the beginning of the day, having a very strong motivation. Today, I'm going to watch my mind and be vigilant and be introspective and so forth. That can cause the whole day to become virtuous. So this is what we try to practice, always to try to have positive motivation, whether it be temporal or causal, the beginning of the day, throughout all of our actions. The first is the force of motivation. This is what we're talking about. This means that we should be vigilant in every moment so that when emotional afflictions arise, we can stop them immediately. It also means that we should be intent upon reserving the three doors of our body, speech, and mind for the cultivation of the awakening mind. These two motivations should be maintained until we achieve the fully awakened state, because they are the soundest basis for future activity. So this, in this sense, Geshe-la was saying that the motivation to always try to avoid negative karma and to try to create virtue all the time with our body, speech, and mind. Remember I said even in words, to recite the words of the teachings verbally, or to recite mantra, to mentally try to have positive thoughts, to be thinking of the Dharma and so forth. So this is the first of the five forces, the force of motivation or determination. Here the second force is the force of familiarity or acquaintance. How do we transform our mind? How do we get better? By familiarizing our mind with it. Those of you who have studied with Geshe-la, the Bodhisattvacharyavatara, you may be familiar with a verse. Shantideva says, there is nothing that does not become easier when we become familiar with it. At first we might think, you know, Robbie can answer all these questions. He can do that study, but me, no way. You know, you might think, oh, Geshe-la can do these great things, but I'm just a beginner. We can all develop good qualities through familiarity. This is the meaning of meditation. The Tibetan word for meditation is gom. Do you know, Vimal? Have you studied some? Gom. That is spelled in a certain way with a superfix above the G, like S-G-O-M. There's another word, and when you ask to define what meditation is, when asked to define that, Maitreya, the future Buddha, said it is the familiarizing the mind. And that's in Tibetan. It sounds the same, gom, but it's spelled differently. It has an A prefix and a G. To familiarize the mind with a wholesome state. That's the meaning of meditation. Why do we meditate? To bring about a transformation of our mind. What's the meaning of meditation? Well, how do we bring about a transformation? By familiarizing. Again and again, going against the grain of your mind, and over days, weeks, months, years, you start to make some progress. So to familiarize your mind with the path, again and again, the teachings, the practices, acquaint yourself. The second force is the force of acquaintance. With this, we become accustomed to the awakening mind so that we are always conscious of our higher aims. By the force of strong acquaintance with this mind, we can use any circumstance, even seeing the misery of a dog's existence, to develop our highest aspiration to attain complete perfection of Buddhahood for the benefit of others. Okay, so the force of motivation at the beginning of the day, throughout the day, for our whole life. They have the motivation to achieve enlightenment by getting rid of our negative qualities, especially these two minds of self-grasping and self-cherishing, and developing all good qualities, both virtue, you know, other qualities of the mind. The third, and then familiarizing our mind with these again and again. The third force that encompasses the lifetime's practice is the force, what's called the force of white seed. The force of the white seed means if you want to have, we know from karma, there is no way that you can experience a result without creating the cause. Have you heard that before when we talk about karma? If you want to have positive qualities, you have to create the cause of those. You have to plant the seed, the white seed of those. So to plant the white seed here in this context has to do with the generation of the mind of bodhicitta. The third is called the force of the white seed. With this, we cultivate the seed of the awakening mind within us, if it has not yet arisen, and we nourish and develop it if it already has. You know, there's a prayer that many of us say at the end of the teachings. Do you say them in Tibetan sometimes? Jangchub Semcho Grimpoche, or do you say in English?
Tibetan on Wednesdays, English on Sundays.
So on Sundays, when you say in English, who knows it by heart? May the Supreme Jewel of Bodhicitta that has not arisen
arise and grow.
Arise and grow.
And may that which has arisen,
which has arisen
not diminish.
But increase more and more. He's a little southern. Yeah, a little southern. We're in North Carolina. So when we talk about this, we're talking about this, what is said right here by Geshe-la. We cultivate the seed of the awakening mind within us if it has not arisen, so that which has not arisen. We also pray, due to the merits that we create, may the Bodhi mind, which has not arisen, not only in our own continuum, but in the minds of others, may it be instituted, may it grow, and that which has begun to grow, may it increase, and of course, may it not diminish, but may it grow even more. If all our actions are directed toward this, they contribute toward its development. Okay, so why... I remember one of the great tantric gurus, Kepche Song Rinpoche. I don't know if any of you encountered Song Rinpoche. Do you remember Song Rinpoche? He was a guru of Lama Sopa and Lama Yeshe. He was the abbot of Ganden Monastery when he was 23. He was recognized as an incarnate Lama. Great tantric yogi, very, very wrathful. Lived to a very old age. In fact, there was when Lama Yeshe passed away, there was an interview with Song Rinpoche, who was still alive. And Song Rinpoche told a story about when he was in his late 60s or 70s, I think, he had gone to see the Dalai Lama. And when Song Rinpoche came, he would be walking with his cane, his eyes were not very clear. And the Dalai Lama said, "Now that the young Rinpoches, the young Tukus, reincarnate Lamas, were beginning to be born in India, there needed to be some example of the older Lamas to lead them. So Rinpoche, you can't die. You have to stay." And so Rinpoche left, and he told his attendant, "I have no choice. I can't die. The Dalai Lama said I have to live." So he started taking the aspect of getting younger. He didn't need his cane any longer. He started looking, you know, about 20 years longer. His eyes got very sharp. This is the power of the mind, obviously. Rinpoche, this was an enlightened being already. But Rinpoche used to say, let me just try to think of what, now I've forgotten what I was going to say. He was going to say. Forgotten. I'll come back to him. We'll just see. I'll just remember that prelude.
Now.
What was I saying just before that? Yeah. Just on the tip of my tongue, I was just... Okay, it's not coming. It'll have to come in a second. So that's the force of the white seed. The fourth is the force of destruction. So this is a little bit like the white seed. Almost coming now. I know it. What Song Rishi said. Okay. When we talk about preliminary practices, some of you have been given by Lama Zopa Rinpoche preliminary practices to do 100,000 this or 500,000 that or something, right? And sometimes you hear about that. I have to do the Tibetans call Ngundro, preliminary practices. Song Rinpoche said, actually the purpose of these practices is to create the karma, the white seed, to develop bodhicitta in a 3-year retreat. If one was going to do a 3-year meditation retreat, hopefully to achieve enlightenment in that time. It's possible. Even in as short a time as 3 years to achieve enlightenment that might take 3 countless great eons through the practice of highest yoga tantra. But you need to have all of the conditions beforehand. In order, during that time, during that retreat, to develop conventional bodhicitta takes an enormous amount of virtuous karma, white seed. So the preliminary practices, that's the reason one does that, Song Rinpoche said. I've never seen that anywhere else. Song Rinpoche was this great tantric adept, though. Perhaps this is something that you only find in the oral teachings. So throughout our life, recognizing if we want to develop good qualities, we have to create virtuous karma. To offer your food, to make offerings to the Buddhas every day, to practice, to recite the sutras, to serve the Dharma Center. My teacher Lama Yeshe used to say that the amount of merit that one accumulates by constructing and perpetuating a Dharma Center that benefits so many people is proportional to the number of atoms in that center. You know, you create an incredible merit because that center continues, benefits so many sentient beings who in turn benefit other sentient beings. So working for a Dharma center is a way to create virtuous karma also. Now, Robbie didn't tell me to plug. This is coming from my there's no... Yeah. If you want to volunteer for anything. So the fourth force is the force of destruction. So this is the state of mind that not only is, as the white seed, is always trying to create the causes for bodhicitta, conventional and ultimate bodhicitta, to rise. The force of destruction is always trying to destroy not only negative karma, but the self-grasping and self-cherishing thought. So that this correlates, this is kind of like the elucidation of a lifetime's practice. You want to have strong motivation, get familiar with the practices so they become part and parcel of your practice, generate all the virtuous qualities from virtuous karma to the virtuous minds, and destroy all that is negative. Negative karma, purify negative karma, but also try to meditate again and again on emptiness to eliminate the self-grasping. Study about that, even though it might seem really difficult. To make aspirations, to be able to, in order to eliminate our self-grasping, we have to understand the texts about emptiness. So to study the preliminary text with the intention of understanding emptiness to get rid of that self-grasping, and in everyday life to erode the self-cherishing thought, to become more loving and kind, to do the Tonglen practice, and to utilize that to overcome adverse conditions. So here it says, the fourth is the force of destruction, is directed against the self-cherishing attitude, which is in complete contradiction to the awakening mind. It is our true enemy and should be destroyed completely. By realizing that this is the cause of all of our confusion and suffering, we should try to check and eradicate it immediately whenever it arises. And the fifth force is the force of prayer. Also, you can call dedication prayer. What's the difference between dedication and prayer? Do you know? What's your name?
Chris.
Chris. Are they completely different, or what? Is one included in the other?
Well, one creates something good, and then you apply that to something else where it's needed.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Let's say prayer. We all have an idea what prayer means, right? By prayer here in the Buddhist context, we don't mean like, who was it? Janis Joplin. Do you remember Janis Joplin? There was a famous, when I was in Laudo, I listened to the shortwave radio sometime, and I remember on the BBC they had an a cappella song that she sang, "Oh God, won't you give me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all have Porsches, I must make amends," and it went on about that. So that's not the kind of prayer we're meaning. You know, oh Buddha, please, I want to find the perfect companion, have lots of money, and you know, washboard abs or whatever. You know, that's not what we mean by prayer here. We're praying in this sense of like the prayer of Samantabhadra. We call the King of Prayers. What's it in your prayer book? What's it called?
King of Prayers.
An aspiration for the future to be able to do these great things. Aspirational prayer. Dedication is a kind of prayer, is a subset of prayer. It's saying, you know, it's not just aspiring that certain things happen in the future, but it's saying, because of this merit, may that happen in the future. So when we talk about the force of prayer here, it includes dedication. We had the first force was the force of motivation. Remember we said at the beginning, it's always important to have a positive motivation, and at the end to dedicate. But here this is talking about even beyond dedicating the merit, the force of prayers that in the future lives will never be separated from these holy teachings, you know. Never be separated from holy gurus that guide us. You know, that's very, very one way that we make dedications always also, because what has really brought us to the Dharma, what awakens it in us is the contact with holy gurus who teach the authentic path. So to make prayers like this, especially to develop the Bodhi mind, the fifth is the force of prayers of aspiration for the path. Although our past unskillful deeds may be numerous, we can clearly see that we have also within us many virtuous seeds that have resulted from past wholesome actions. The mere fact that we have obtained this precious human life endowed with the qualities that allow us to follow a spiritual path is obvious proof of this. Yeah, if you just sometimes you think, oh, how miserable I am. Just the fact that you have a life of leisure and endowment is proof that you've created some incredible virtue in the past. Therefore, we should utilize the power of this aspiration for the path and dedicate all the virtuous conduct and merits we've created in this and prior lifetimes that we may remain inseparable from the practice of cultivating the awakening mind from now until ultimate realization. So in a sense, these five forces, this is a way that you can elaborate. You can say, my main goal is to achieve enlightenment. That's one thing. To do that, I have to develop wisdom and compassion, or the ultimate mind of bodhicitta and conventional bodhicitta. Then if we elaborate that, how to bring that about, these five forces, force of motivation or determination, force of familiarity, the force of the white seed, the force of destruction, and the force of prayer, which includes dedication. Some of you may have heard of a practice called transference of consciousness, POA. Has someone heard? Sometimes.
Yeah, teachings on that from Kirti Sanchat Rinpoche about 10 years ago.
Ah. So, in the...
Some of us people here were not.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. So there are ways to, at the time of death, to certain yogic methods to cause one's consciousness to be ejected just before the natural death into the pure land, just at the time of death. Those methods are called the wrathful method of transference of consciousness. Also in the Lama Chopa Puja, near the end of the puja, near the glance meditation, it talks about the guru's instruction of transference of consciousness, which is what is talked about now in the text. The same five forces that we just talked about can be applied when a person is nearing death. The most powerful way to ensure a future rebirth in the human realm, to continue our spiritual practice. When people ask, what can I do for someone who's dying? Sometimes people say, oh, read the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Have you ever heard that? Mm-hmm. Also, Song Rinpoche, he was very wrathful about this. He said, oh, that's no use at all. Tibetan Book of the Dead was something, actually it's called Liberation Through Hearing in the Bardo Todol. To means to hear, drol means liberate. Bardo is the intermediate state. So what it means is when a person is dying, certain tantric texts that explain the practices they've practiced all their life are recited to them just when their mind is becoming more and more subtle to remind them in the intermediate state that they can meditate in that state and possibly achieve enlightenment. That's a very high practice and it's not the usual kind of practice. Usually a high practitioner doesn't have to be reminded at the time. So the actual thing, the best thing you can do for people when they're practicing, if they're Dharma practitioners, is to remind them of these five forces to be applied at the time of death. So the next aphorism, the next verse says, the instruction for the great vehicle transmigration of consciousness, transference of consciousness, Mahayana transference of consciousness, is to apply these very five forces lying in the perfect posture. You know what the perfect posture is? Doesn't mean seated in the Vajra position. It means seated as the Buddha laid at the time of death, on your right side with your right hand under your cheek, and even closing the three entrances, the nose, the eye, and the ear, with the right hand, the left hand along one side and legs out. Have you ever seen the Buddha? The pictures of the Buddha in Parinirvana? You don't see that other mudra, but that's some supplementary. Many of the great beings, when they pass away that way. That's how the Buddha passed away. So here, one tries to that is useful at the time of death, but right before that, one tries in the weeks and days before death, one meditates on these five forces. They're applied a little bit differently at the time of death. The order, remember we talked about, what was the order? Motivation, familiarity, white seed, destruction, prayer. So here, let me read what Geshe-la said. The time of death, when our consciousness begins to transfer to another lifetime, is crucial. So we should be well prepared for it. We're going to transfer to another lifetime whether we want it or not. You know, it's not like you have to do something to, you know, otherwise your mind is going to remain here. It's going to transfer whether you want to or not. But you can cause that to be a transference to a positive state by preparing your mind at that crucial point. Of course, you should practice the five forces during the life, but at the time of death, this can be done by means of the five forces, although here they are of a somewhat different nature from those applied during our life. The first, in this case, is the force of the white seed. When we realize that we are soon to leave this existence, we should prepare by discarding every one of our objects of attachment. So, if you have the opportunity to make a will, to offer your things so that at the time of death, there's not going to be any clinging or any kind of argumentation in your presence. This can be very, very disturbing, right? Did any of you see, I bet Robbie's seen this one, the All Quiet on the Western Front?
Mm-hmm.
You know that movie? It's an old classic. There's one scene that's very, very telling. There's a one of there's a couple of companions that are in World War I. One of them's a little more wealthy than the others, and he has a pair of hand-tooled boots, not the army-issued, you know, GI boots. And he's been injured in the trenches from mortar shell or something, and he's on a cot in the hospital, and his friends have come. He's near death, and his boots are seated up on the table next to him. And one of his friends is talking to him and looking at him, looking at the boots, looking at him, looking at the boots. That's probably happened with when grandma's and mom and dad have passed away, and families, maybe you've recognized that or you've heard stories. People being present when someone is dying and perhaps, you know, being artificial, causing interference, arguing even over the possessions. So what we try to do is to avoid that, we actually create virtuous karma at the time of death. We give away everything and we dedicate it, usually to the most powerful objects, to our gurus, to spiritual organizations, to the needy, so that we create this white seed of karma at that time, extra karma that we might not otherwise think of creating. So we avoid the possibility of argumentation and distraction and so forth, and we create this positive seed, the white seed. This should be done by donating all our wealth and possessions as charity to others, or giving them to deserving spiritual cause. To do this is very beneficial, because then, at the time of death, strong craving or attachment, which would only bind us more tightly to cyclic existence, will have little opportunity to arise. I might have mentioned another story Lama Yeshe used to tell. There was a meditator who was sitting on his cushion and trying to do transference of consciousness near death. His guru could tell, the guru had clairvoyance, he could tell this monk was not able to complete the transference because he was attached to the mug of butter tea in front of him. Did I tell this story?
No.
So the lama, in order for this person to be successful, he was able to cause some sound to reverberate in this person's mind. There is better tea in Tushita heaven. Otherwise, if we're grasping to the things that are here right now, it's very difficult to be able to let go, you know, and go on to the next life. We grasp, you know, when I asked what the cause of samsara was, I think you had said, was it you or someone said tanha? Who said that? Thirst.
Chris
had said tanha. That in the Theravada tradition, we say that's the cause that causes us to continue to cycle in cyclic existence. So this kind of craving, wanting to have continuity of life, wanting to have the possessions of this life, to try to get rid of that at the time of death by the force of the white seed, giving everything away so that you can leave unencumbered. Okay? That's the first, that's how at the time of death we apply these, the first of the five forces. The second is the force of aspiration or prayer at the time of death. We should make offerings to the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and our spiritual masters, our gurus. We should not be content with giving material objects. The best offerings to make in this instance are the seeds of all our virtuous merits that we've ever accumulated. This is the most pleasing offering to the objects of refuge. When we make such offerings, they should be conjoined with a prayer such as following. Now and at all times, this is a little bit reminiscent of the prayer that's done in Lama Chopa also, just before the glance meditation on the path, which is called placing the stake in the ground. Like when you if you're going to put up a tent, if you just pound in the stake that the ropes are tied to just an inch or two, the tent might blow away, right? You have to pound it in a long way. So it's like this Tibetan ritual dagger they call the purbu, really. Putting it, we make a very strong motivation, very strong prayer. You know, you are the guru, you are the Buddha. Is that you guru, you are the Buddha, you are the Dharma, you are the Sangha, you are the Dakas and Dakinis too. You are the protectors. In this life and in future lives, I will seek no refuge other than you. You know, please bind me with your hooks of compassion. Be my, you know, steadfast friend and help me overcome the fears of samsara and nirvana. These kind of prayers. So here the prayer that Geshe-la was referring to was, now and at all times, through my death, the intermediate state, the next and all subsequent incarnations, bless me never to be apart from this practice of the developing the two bodhicittas. May I always be guided by true spiritual teachers who repeatedly lead me to cultivate the awakening mind. So this is, if one of our Dharma practitioners of the center who's received teachings like this and has tried to practice through their life, this is what we should remind them of at the time of death, while they're still conscious and able to practice in those last days. So they can make offerings, the power of the white seed, the power of prayer again and again. The force of destruction. In this case, we should first understand that the primary cause of continuing to spin through the wheel of existence is grasping at the self, at grasping at wealth, relatives, possessions, and friends. Once we recognize this, clinging is our greatest enemy, we should try to eradicate every trace of such attachment, constricting our chance of freedom. So to make a very strong decision, you know, that in the future life also, I'm going to try to destroy the continuity of self-grasping and self-cherishing thought, and to meditate on that at the time of death, to do Tonglen, to try to eradicate the self-cherishing at that time. Then there's the force of motivation, which was, remember before, that had come first. The force of motivation, we should have a strong intention as death approaches to carry on the practice of generating the awakening mind, even through the intermediate stage between death and rebirth. Remember the story of my dad making the determination to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, or to remember your dreams. Here, if you make a very strong motivation not to be separated from this thought, even in the intermediate state, when you take on a new mind, like a dream state, there is the chance that by the force of that very strong determination or motivation, you will recall bodhicitta even then. If we make this firm intention, then the awakening mind will arise spontaneously, even though normally at a time like this, there is no such freedom of action. So is that the five forces? Did I get all five?
No.
What's missing?
Familiarizing.
We should also be prepared with the force of familiarity or acquaintance and be especially familiar with the awakening mind. This should be done, you know, by again and again meditating on the benefits of it and its procedure. How do we develop the mind of bodhicitta? First of all, we develop heartwarming love for others. And there are various ways of doing that. To remember how sentient beings have been kind as our mother, how they've been kind as our companions, our family, as strangers, as enemies, and as the field of merit. Developing a heartwarming love that Atisha had when he would look out at the cows in the field, and the disciples would hear him saying, you know, as he looked at them, Mother. You know, feeling that sort of, even though the form may be different, that we don't recognize, they've all been intimately close to us. They're all deserving of our affection. To get familiar with this, and then on the basis of that, to feel empathy for them through our understanding of the nature of suffering, of cyclic existence, wishing them to be free of all of this ocean of cyclic existence. Weighing on one hand how we could do that, we're not even in a position now to alleviate our own suffering. The only way that we can do that is by ourself achieving a state of perfection, of enlightenment. That's the only way that we can really help all sentient beings. So thinking, I want to help sentient beings, but the only way to help them is I must attain enlightenment. Recognizing also through your meditation on emptiness that enlightenment is possible, then generating that thought, I will achieve enlightenment for their benefit. That's what I'm going to do. So that's the kind of familiarization that we do at that time. This should be done in the perfect position or posture, lying on the right side with the cheek supported by the right palm and the ring finger closing the nostril. Here, my teacher taught also these three, Amayasha used to say like this, these three orifices being closed. Then while we are breathing, we should practice giving and taking, tong len, instead of wasting our breath. So when the time of death comes, when the doctors recognize that, or if you recognize that, to lie in that posture and try to do tong len as you're passing away. This is called the instruction of the Mahayana transference of consciousness. What are we doing? So we're on the section of elucidating or condensing a lifetime's practice. So once we talked about the five forces applied during the life, five forces as Mahayana instructions at the time of death. Now the next aphorism here in this section says, all practices collect into one intention. All dharma collects into one intention. This and the next verse are the last two here. They sometimes come in the next section, the measure of having transformed the mind. So this is kind of interesting. These instructions, the seven-point training of the mind, were transferred down through the Kadampa Geshes. And there wasn't a clear demarcation of which verse went in the various points. Sometimes they're arranged in different ways and they can be interpreted in different ways. But here we're going to interpret it firstly here in this section, elucidating one lifetime's practice. But I'll explain how next two verses can go into the next section also. All dharma collects into one intention. All practices. All methods of the different traditions of the dharma that were taught by the Buddha have the same intention and goal, the destruction of the self-cherishing attitude and self-grasping ignorance. If we approach this goal steadily, our practice is progressing well. But if nothing is bringing these real targets closer to destruction, something is wrong in our approach. In this case, then just as we would add weight to one side of an unbalanced scale to bring it into equilibrium, we should add more energy to our practice by applying the appropriate methods of meditation more diligently than before. So another way of saying this is that in this context of talking about it as elucidating a life's practice, all of our practice goes into the intention of developing these two Bodhi minds. So whatever is lacking, if our practice is not making any progress, to put energy through perhaps seeking advice from our spiritual friends, the Sangha, and our masters, put energy into that which is lacking. Sometimes if we're just left on our own devices, we may be kind of coasting along in our practice. We won't necessarily put energy. So it's very essential to seek the guidance of our spiritual guides to know where, you know, sometimes our gurus ask us to go off and do, in my life, my teachers have sent me, even when I thought, I was very comfortable someplace, they say, now you have to go here. And you have to go here, do this, do that. I remember once in Italy, many times Lama said this, he would say something like, okay, now one obstacle removed, now next one. You know, where is he going to send you next to get rid of the next obstacle? You know. The next aphorism says, retain the two witnesses of foremost importance. So when we talk about witnesses, here we're talking about witnesses of our spiritual progress. One, there are two witnesses of our spiritual progress.